And now NBC's award-winning program, Conversation.
Miss Stratton and Mr. Lerner, when I was young, there was an old cliché. How did it go? If you're not a radical at 20 and a conservative at 40, you're a fool. What was that old saw? Do you remember?
That's as accurate as you're likely to get.
Well, the notion was that it's natural for youth to be radical, and it's wise for them to learn to be more conservative at a later time. Wouldn't you say that the young folks, let's say people from about 13 to 20, more or less, wouldn't you say, on the whole, they are more conservative than their elders, Miss Stratton?
It seems so to me, on the basis of the surveys that we've had.
This is a program we call Conversation. It's dedicated to the art of good talk. Our host is Clifton Fadiman, editor of the American Treasury. His guests tonight are Dorothy C. Stratton, National Executive Director of the Girl Scouts, and Max Lerner, Professor of American Civilization and formerly Dean of the Graduate School of Brandeis University. Our guests are talking about the current younger generation as they discuss unflaming youth. In just 60 seconds, we'll hear more of tonight's conversation. But first, hear this. You know, a lot of parents nowadays think that all it'll take when their children are ready for college will be enough money. But the real problem of getting into college within the next few years involves quite a bit more. Right now, colleges and universities are jammed. Enrollments are at an all-time high. There's a critical shortage of classrooms, laboratories, and dormitories. Even more serious is the shortage of qualified professors, some of whom even now are leaving for better-paying professions. Worse than that, there are fewer and fewer young men and women training to replace them. That's the situation today, and within the next 10 years, when the number of applications will double, there'll be even less room and fewer professors. We have a free booklet which gives you all the facts about the crisis now facing our colleges and universities. Find out how you can help. For the free booklet, write to Higher Education, Box 36, Times Square, New York 36, New York. And now as we turn up our microphones, our conversationalists are discussing unflaming youth. Clifton Fadiman is speaking.
It would seem so. Mr. Lerner, I don't know whether you had a chance to go over that survey that Miss Stratton very kindly sent to us. At any rate, this is a very involved, complex study of adolescent girls made by careful random samplings by the Research Institute of the University of Michigan. And some of the things that came out of that survey astonished these old eyes, as Alec Wolcott used to say. There doesn't seem to be, from this survey, much admiration of mere intelligence among the young. Only 4% of the girls stated any admiration for either intelligence or smartness as a work skill. Only 4%. Does that seem unusual to you?
It does to me, miss. Yes, it does.
Well, you have to ask what life goals they learn from the culture. And I don't think that our culture is one in which intelligence is particularly the great life goal. Oh, except on television and radio. That's another matter.
You mean when it's tied up with commerce?
Yes.
Well, now, I don't know that's entirely fair, Mr. Lerner.
But, Mr. Fadiman, you say they're not, they don't regard intelligence highly, and that may be true, yet one-third of the girls say they want to go to college. I don't know whether there's any correlation between intelligence and going to college, but it's rather interesting.
It is, but I think the point that The doubt that you raise in my mind is an interesting one. Do they correlate going to college with training of the mind?
Going to college has become a status obligation in our generation. And something that you do in order to have the right standing in life for many of these youngsters, not for all.
And wouldn't you say also that it's a form of social adventure rather than anything else?
Especially for the girls, I think.
Yes, but I think even for my own sex. Very often, isn't it a mating factory, too? A chance to find a mate in college?
I would distinguish, Mr. Fadiman, between social adventure and mating search. Because you may go out for a mating search without very much sense of adventure, which is one of the deadly things, I think, about our young generation now.
You mean they just stalk their prey?
And the prey has very little chance. Partly that, but partly that it's something that you feel you have to do, you see. It's not something where you say what infinite possibilities there are in life ahead for us. You feel I'm going to get my young man, and just as soon as I get him, we're going to pair off, and we'll go steady, and eventually we'll get married.
Did you notice one phrase that Mr. Lerner used? This is one of the things he said they have to do. That's a curious phrase for a youngster to use about himself. This is one of the things we have to do. Doesn't it seem, Miss Stratton, as if young people, adolescents and post-adolescents of today, are much more conscious of social conventions surrounding them to which they have to obey than youngsters were, let's say, 25 or 30 years ago?
Well, it seems so, as we thought of ourselves, at least, as being very rebellious, didn't we?
Well, there is a value in rebellion.
Per se, you mean?
In itself, yes, per se. I remember speaking with an English administrator in one of the West Indian Islands, and he was a wonderful person. His family in England was Methodist and evidently quite strongly so, and he was explaining to me why he brought his children up strictly. Mm-hmm. He said, "I bring them up strictly so that they will become rebels. Only if they have a really strong father discipline authority there can you possibly hope that they'll become rebels. Otherwise, what is there to rebel against?"
Well, that's, I think, the key. What is there to rebel against? At least that's one of the things that I think this shows. Now, there appears to be more of a desire to conform than our generation had.
Why, do you think?
Our generation, of course, hadn't had the Second World War, certainly, and we hadn't had the severity of the Depression. But sometimes I wonder if we're just getting lost in numbers, the sheer numbers with... Now, there's just so many of us and so many young people that they lose a sense of identity. And whether that may be a factor in this early search for security, this early search for knowing what you're going to do.
That's an interesting point.
I think there are so many other factors, Miss Stratton, in our world that might explain the thing that we're trying to explain, which I think we'd probably all agree on, and that is the desperate sense of insecurity that the young people seem to have.
But you have to go back of that.
That's what I say. You'd have to try to find some factors to explain what we'd agree on, that there is a sense of insecurity, but what in turn is it which produces that insecurity?
I would tend to deny, Miss Stratton, that it comes about as a consequence of our having passed through two terrible world wars and a depression, because youngsters in their teens... I have no historical sense at all, as far as I can see. Some of them have some memory of the last war. But on the whole, they don't realize that their country has passed through two tragic episodes. I don't think it affects them.
It affects the family situation, don't you think? The point of view of the parents?
Well, do you think that it seeps down from the heads of the family, the sense of insecurity to the children?
I think it probably does. And I can't quite give up the point that perhaps the sheer numbers are weighing on us in having brought so many people into our communities that the individual becomes relatively unimportant.
One trouble with that, Miss Stratton, is that you will find conformity just as strong in the small town, very small town, as you do in the very big city, or in the smaller city, or in the suburb.
Yeah, we used to always put it the other way, didn't we? That the small town was the conformist and the big city wasn't.
Yes, and now you will find, I think you find different brands of conformity in the big city or the suburb or the small town. But aren't we dealing with something here which cuts across all these population centers or strata? I think it is a difficult thing to put your finger on, but I think you had your finger on it when you were speaking of the effect on the family. Whatever it is that affects the family is likely to affect this. That is, I think these young people, Mr. Fadiman, don't you feel that they get whatever their psychological tone is, not so much from the world outside, the world of the hydrogen bomb or the world of depressions or whatever it is. That seeps in. But mostly they get it from the people that they spend all day with, from mother and father, from brother and sister, from teacher, from neighboring kid.
But, Mr. Lerner, I think that makes cogent sense until I begin to apply it to some cases I know of where the mothers and fathers are themselves, and even in their 50s, relatively adventurous, relatively rebellious, I know one seated here to my left, yourself, Mr. Lerner, whose mind is as keener than it was when you were younger, I'm sure. But I know in your own family, for example, the last thing that you would try to propagandize for in your family circle is over-adjustment, unadventurousness, the immediate search for security and so forth. Am I not right in saying
that?
Oh,
I hope you're right.
And yet, wouldn't it, I'm now guessing, but isn't it true that even in your own family circle you find a certain submissiveness, perhaps, among certain members of the family?
I have so many children, Mr. Fadiman, that I could practically do a statistical table.
I realize that you yourself are a random sample or can provide one without much trouble.
No, but your basic point, I think, is quite right. Our generation is decidedly more adventurous than the generation that follows us.
Aren't we complacent, Miss Stratton?
Yes, we are.
And I wish it weren't so, because they seem to regard us as really immoral people. I get this feeling from many youngsters.
But the strange thing to me is that in the 20s, when we had what was called flaming youth, we thought that was a very bad thing.
It was.
Youth was criticized for flaming. And now, when we find that they're not in rebellion so much, then we say, well, they are too complacent. They are too self-satisfied.
Grown-ups are never satisfied.
Never satisfied.
You know, it may be, Miss Stratton, I hesitate to advance this diabolical notion, but perhaps we're critical of the current sobriety of youth because they're not acting as vicars for the immoralities which we didn't have when we were young ourselves. We expect them.
In a moment, we'll return to Mr. Fadiman and his guests for more conversation. 25 years ago, the mentally ill were considered hopeless and doomed. Since then, science has discovered new methods for treating mental illness. Each year now, tens of thousands of patients are being treated successfully. They're able to return to their homes, their families, their jobs. Yet, for each patient who goes home, countless others are tragically left behind, unable to leave because there isn't enough hospital staff to give them adequate, effective treatment. As a result, patients who could be made well enough to go home may never go home at all. Science has shown that the mentally ill can come back. You can help to bring them back. Join the Mental Health Association in your community. Work for better services and facilities for the mentally ill. Give them the precious gift of hope. Send a contribution today to your local mental health campaign or to Mental Health, care of your postmaster. That's to your local mental health campaign or to Mental Health, care of your postmaster. And now we rejoin our conversationalists who are discussing unflaming youth. Dorothy Stratton is speaking.
Do you think it may be possible that there are so many more opportunities available now than there were for our generation that if you can see an opportunity really to do something constructive, you don't have to spend so much of your energy rebelling. You're pretty sure that you're going to have a good job, for example, which we weren't sure of.
Yes, that purpose too. Is that a good thing or a bad?
Well, I think it's a good thing.
To know that you're going to have a job, I'm going to think it's bad. In my own time, and I'm sure this is true of Mr. Lerner, too, we hadn't the slightest notion of how we were going to get along. Nowadays, as I understand it, the youngster at 15 is already worried about an abstract concept that never occurred to me at that age, the concept of security. It's a notion that didn't have any place in our mental cosmos, Miss Stratton, and now it seems to bulk so large in the minds of youngsters of 14 or 15.
The interesting thing about insecurity is that it can lead in several directions. That is, insecurity can lead into a kind of wildness because you're so insecure, you're trying desperately for all kinds of possibilities, or it can lead into a terrible tameness. So insecure you don't want to take any risks. And the interesting thing is that in our case, it didn't cut down on the risk-taking, let's say in the 1920s and the 1930s. In both decades, there was a kind of risk-taking.
Well, there was a kind of aliveness, I think, in both decades, had its bad elements, too. It's that aliveness that look for rather wistfully among the youngsters of today.
I know what you mean, but I'd like to advance another possible theory as to why the youngsters seem to be conformists more than our generation did. We have made tremendous advances in understanding human behavior.
We have indeed.
This understanding is not centered in a few people. It's rather widespread now, some understanding of human motivation and behavior. This may be a factor in if your parents and your friends and your teachers do have more understanding of you, you don't have to rebel against them.
Well, that's a rather hopeful statement. There may be a good deal of cogency in it. Miss Stratton, I was going to ask you about something else in connection with this, the study of adolescent girls. I mean, one of the most important things that ever happens to a girl, not to speak of a boy, is falling in love and getting married. It's a major experience. I noticed that these youngsters ask the question, what do you admire most or want most from in the conceivable man of your choice? That the great majority of them stressed kindness and consideration. And out of the total sampling, only 8% answered, I want him to love me. I find that shocking. Kindness, in the first place, you can be kind to a dog. Kindness is certainly not something that you can base a marriage on. That is, exclusively.
To have a husband who is kind and considerate and therefore reliable, this is a sheer question of human treatment. You see, this is a question of aiming for the moderate values, not for the romantic ones.
Yes, I understand that, but I find that shocking, being a member of a romantic generation.
Also, it's very surprising to me that the career ambitions are so unexciting. I mean, secretary and...
Well, now, there. I'm glad you brought that up. I have another notation here I want to ask you about. 31% of the girls that were questioned selected nice people to work with as the main thing they wanted out of a job. Now, that seems curious to me. Nice people to work with.
This may relate to the point you made earlier. This may be the mate-seeking again,
yes,
although it may
possibly be
much more than that. And apparently, job opportunities and advancement and money are relatively unimportant factors compared to the people you work with being, quotes, nice, quotes.
Yes. Well, the job then becomes part of a social rather than a competitive universe. The job is again a mating place, possibilities there, and it becomes a way of raising your social status, as I think Mr. Lerner mentioned earlier in our discussion. But again, to go back to our own generation, I don't think that was the way we thought of it. We thought of a job as a challenge.
That's right.
Mr. Fadiman, I wonder if we can tackle it from a somewhat different point of view, and that is to say I want nice people to work with may mean all the things you say it does, and I think it does, but it may also mean I feel desperately alone, and I want to break out of the skin of my aloneness, and I want to bridge this distance between me and others.
Yeah.
And how am I going to bridge it best? Well, I'm afraid to bridge it. I'm afraid of what it will mean unless the people to whom I'm going to build the bridge are nice people. Unless I'm surrounded by nice people so that I can connect myself with them without too much danger, without too much risk. And this may be one of the clues to the whole business. And that is that this feeling that you have got to make a connection, which obviously, of course, underlies the whole quest for mate and the quest for love. It's become a truism, but I think it's true nevertheless to say that love is the effort to get out of your own aloneness and to make some sort of connection with another human being. But these figures from the study that you're talking about suggest to me that the historians of the future may well call our period the age of togetherness.
What worries me is the fact that they try to break down the isolation of themselves by being like everybody else instead of by trying to lead other people. And by leadership, I mean a good leadership rather than non-constructive leadership. For example, out of this group that were questioned, 48% said they didn't care at all about ever being their own boss when they had a job. Doesn't this seem a rather frightening situation?
Could I go back? I've been groping for some explanation of the thing we were talking about a while ago, and when Miss Stratton spoke of the number of people we have, maybe we could shift it a little. Maybe it isn't the number of people we have, but how rapidly they move.
I thought of that.
That is not only geographically moving, but also in terms of social movement. They're moving from one class to another all the time. Yeah. And most of the people of the United States now either are in different places, living in different places from those that their fathers or grandfathers lived in, or else are in a different class from what their ancestors were. And as a result, they just don't know where they belong.
I think that's true, Ms. Patton.
I'm very glad you made that point, Mr. Lern, because it was one of the things I was thinking about, too. Is I think the mobility of the population, both in actual geographic terms and in the social mobility, must be...
And so you get what the sociologists call a status anxiety. You're terribly anxious about what your status is, what people think of you, whether you're alone, whether you have friends, and all the rest of it. And I suppose that our young people now are sort of paying the price for the enormous growth and development of the United States in all these generations.
It seems a shame that they should be the one to pay this penalty.
They're the scapegoats.
You've been listening to Conversation, a series of programs dedicated to the art of good talk. Our host was Clifton Fadiman, author of Party of One. His guests tonight were Max Lerner, columnist of the New York Post, and Dorothy C. Stratton, executive director of the Girl Scouts.